Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Donna Eschenbrenner. Eschenbrenner attended Manhattan College and NYU, where she studied English literature. Her early career was in publishing and teaching English to foreign students, but she always wanted to work in the field of history. In 1999, she volunteered as an assistant to the archivist at what was then called the DeWitt Historical Society, and in 2001, she became the director of archives and research services for what we now call the History Center of Tompkins County. And welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Tish.
Now, even though you studied English literature, you say you've always were interested in history. What prompted that interest?
It actually started with one of my English professors who focused very heavily on the historical aspects of the literature that we were studying. And I suddenly realized, as I was about halfway through my English degree, that I was studying the wrong field. But at that point, the horse was halfway through the stream, so I figured it was too late to change my mind. So I stayed with the English lit, but then pursued history as a hobby after that.
I see, yeah. It's an interesting segue, I must say. Now, you began your history adventure by volunteering at the DeWitt
That's
Historical
right.
Society. How did you learn? Did you just learn on the job? How did you learn how to be an archivist?
The person who was the archivist at the time had just come out of a graduate program for archival studies, and he was a very capable, very smart young man, and he was very willing to train me. Mm-hmm. He gave me a lot of his work from his graduate program to read and to study up myself, and then he spent the next year actually training me on the spot there at the History Center.
Wow, that's what an amazing story that is.
Yeah.
What aspects of history were you initially interested in?
English history. I was interested in 19th century English history because that's where my love of literature had been mostly, 18th and 19th century English lit. And so I started studying English history, and then I segued off a little bit to American history, and then I became very interested in local history when I started working at the DeWitt.
And, you know, I've always wanted to ask somebody who works in archives, how does it work? At the History Museum. Do you actually go out into the field? Do you have people with estates that call and say, we might have historical papers and stuff here? How does that work?
The answer to the first question is no. The answer to the second question is yes. No, we do not go out and actively pursue collections. We can't at the History Center. We don't have a budget to do anything like that. So what we do is we gratefully receive donations that are made by, as you say, people with estates, people with records, people from businesses or institutions that have records. For example, we received an enormous collection from the Ithaca Opera Association.
Wow.
They actually shut down. After a 50-year career, they decided that they could no longer afford to put on operas, so they had institutional records going back for decades. So they approached us and asked us to take their records.
And the History Center, the building itself seems kind of small. Well, where do you put all this stuff?
The building is kind of small, and the way I like to describe it sometimes is we are a size 9 foot in a size 8 shoe, and we are kind of limping along. It's working. We are squeezed in on one floor of what is now the Gateway Building, and it's cramped.
Yeah, so you constantly needing more space.
Right.
So how do you do research? Somebody gives you some materials. How do you know they're of historical value? Do you consult with historians in town?
Yes and no. We have about 3 or 4 different criteria that we look upon as fixed for us when it comes to taking a donation. The first and most important thing is it local? Is this something that is reflective of Tompkins County history? If somebody's trying to donate something from, say, Pittsburgh, it's obviously not relevant for us. The second thing is it in good condition? Mm-hmm. Is it something that's not mildewy, that's not damaged in any way, that's still usable? And the third thing is it something that we don't already have? Mm. Is it something that another repository doesn't already have? For example, there's a fabulous archive up at Cornell. If they have records on certain things, we try not to duplicate their efforts.
So you try to find unique,
exactly.
Something unique
exactly.
About it. Well, what connotes history, though, in this day and age? How old does it have to be?
Tish, if it's from yesterday, it's historical.
Really?
It really is. And that's one thing that a lot of people forget, because everything that we do in the course of our lives, the businesses that we interact with, the stores that we shop at, the clothing that we wear, the movies that we watch, everything builds up, everything constitutes the material culture of a community. And those things are all valuable. For example, when we work with student groups and we take them, I give them a tour of the archives and I show them things. We have an enormous and I think very nice textile collection. And I show them the clothing that people were wearing 100 years ago. And I explain to them how that helps them learn about the people that preceded us in Tompkins County 100 mm-hmm. years prior to that. So I point to the things that they're wearing and I say, you know, you see those Uggs that you're wearing? 10 years from now, those are going to be historical artifacts. Think of everything that you do, everything that you work with, as being important down the road. Yeah. So we try to preserve things even from as recently as yesterday because we know it's going to be important in the future.
And I've just noticed just in the last 10 or 15 years with computers and you know, high tech, how fast it changes. We've got old computers in the basement that look like something from the 1800s by today's standards. It is quite amazing.
Exactly.
How has digitalization changed the way history is told or preserved and how artifacts are saved?
It is an ongoing process, and I'm watching it kind of with my eyes wide open and my mouth slightly agape because it's something that's moving so quickly. We are seeing that things are becoming increasingly preserved digitally. We are seeing that things are becoming increasingly requested in digital format. For example, we have an enormous photo collection at the History Center, and it was always accessed by people. Scholarly researchers would use it, but casual browsers would use it. People coming in saying, oh, you know, my dad's interested in old planes, and I want to buy him a photograph for a birthday present. You have photographs of old planes. Nowadays, someone would come in and say, do you have a photograph of old planes? Can you scan it for me so I can put it on my phone and email it to my dad?
Wow. That's how it's changed then. Right. Well, so it does make history more accessible, obviously, to more people in many ways.
It does in so many ways, but here's the archivist in me speaking now. In a way, sometimes I think something is lost in the process because while I'm so delighted that all of these things are becoming more accessible to people just at the touch of a button on a computer or on a cell phone, I feel that there's something lost in not seeing the original artifact, mm-hmm. the original photograph. Holding a photograph that's 100 years old in your hands is very different than seeing it as an image on a screen.
Absolutely.
And that's one of the things we try to impart to our users, especially the students that we work with.
So and on that note, how do you make sure that some of these artifacts don't get ruined if they are being handled all the time by people? How do you save them?
We are very careful first in our preservation process. So we have things we call them archival boxes. They're acid-free boxes, acid-free folders. We have sleeves that we put photographs in. We have special tissue paper that we use for things like textiles. And we handle things very carefully. And when we allow people access, we teach them how to handle things. So, for instance, when I work with student groups, one of the first things I do when I give them an orientation is teach them usage. I teach them the protocols, how to use things, how to handle things, how to turn the pages of, say, a 100-year-old book, how yeah. to move things from one folder to another as they're examining papers from an archival collection.
Yeah.
We teach it.
You'd have to wear gloves and so on. You know, going back to being able to see the artifacts and stuff in person, that God, there's just no way not to describe how different that is.
Yes.
The first time I saw Van Gogh's paintings in the Netherlands at his museum, I couldn't believe how different
right.
everything looked. The textures and the distances, you can go forward and backward and see different images. It's quite amazing to see things in person, you're right. Because Tompkins County is so filled with Native American history as well, how is that dealt with at the History Museum? Do you have Native Americans who help you disseminate some of the artifacts?
Unfortunately, we don't. And that's one thing I lament because we have a few things in the collection that represent Native American history. We don't know that much about it. It's one of the pitfalls of working in a very small institution. Things have come in. Sometimes we don't know the provenance. It means we don't know the history of these individual items. We mm-hmm. don't always know who the donor was. We're not sure, is this an artifact that was created by, say, Native Americans recently that was meant to reflect their history in the past, or was it really made in the past? We don't know. And that's one of the areas of the collection where we don't have a lot of information.
Is anything being done about that? Because there must be Native Americans in New York State who are interested in their own history.
There are, but I would imagine they're probably more focused on the things in their own holdings, in their own collection, more than they are in ours. And no, it's one area that we would love to be able to pursue. We just don't have the means or the wherewithal to do that yet.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the History Center and the history and its services. I know it actually began in 1863 or thereabouts, right? Ezra Cornell was interested in starting a historical society. To tell us a little bit more about those early days.
Well, Ezra and some of the other prominent citizens that he was working with at the time formed what they call the Ithaca Historical and Scientific Society, which I think is a nice reflection of the emphasis of the time. We have records from it for about a year at that point. And then from about 1865-ish on, we have no records. We assume that the institution went dormant.
That was during the Civil War, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It was during the Civil War, and it was also during a time of great distraction for Ezra Cornell. He was busy founding a greater institution up the street.
Yeah.
So we think he was distracted at the time. It was resuscitated again in 1899 by another group of prominent citizens. And at that point, they called it the DeWitt Historical Society. It lasted for about 6 or 7 years, and then the records drop off again. And then it was resuscitated finally in 1935, and we've been around ever since.
God, that's amazing. It's amazing. And during those early days, did they have an archives? Were they saving things, or were they just debating, you know?
They were doing both. They were, in fact, collecting and saving things. And I lament to say that many of the things that they saved from those earliest days were not preserved. They wound up going up to Cornell.
So do you work with Cornell still? I mean, I know there was a connection, obviously, with Ezra.
Well, we are really pretty much a separate institution. We have a very cordial working relationship with all of the institutions, you know, in the community. We have our Discovery Trail partners, and Cornell, for example, the Division of Rare and Manuscript Collections is an extraordinary institution, and I have worked with them on a few occasions very contentedly, but we're not in any way affiliated with Cornell.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Tell us a little bit about some of the services that the Historical Center has. Research library, and that's open to students as well as the general public, correct?
Yes, exactly.
Tell us what it entails.
The research library is, you think of the archives and the research library as sort of two sides to a coin. The research library is the access point for all the archival materials that we have. So, say someone would like to come in and study the history of their house. That's where they would do it. The library is a big, beautiful room with old-fashioned tables with some of our library books and some of, I'd like to say, the tip of the iceberg in terms of the collections. We have genealogy files there. We have map drawers with historic maps. That's where people come. They are served by either myself or one of my research assistants, one of my volunteers, and we go to and from the archives. Once we discern what their needs are, we go to and from the archives, pulling materials for them and bring them out so that they can research them right then and there in our library.
Wow, that's a great service. Do you work with the Tompkins County Public Library, too? I'm sure they have a whole bunch of records and obviously a bit more room, perhaps.
Yeah, they do, and that's also another cordial working relationship. We have worked on a number of projects with them over the years, one of which I'm very pleased about. We lent them several books from our collection for them to digitize.
Ah.
They have greater resources at their disposal. So they had a grant to digitize maps and local history books. So we lent them some of ours quite happily. And now they're digital and available online. Part of that digital, you know, extravaganza that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. Are there some things that you can't digitize?
Probably. There are things that are too fragile, like maps, for example. Some of the larger maps require, you know, an enormous flatbed scanner. It's difficult. I think it's possible to do it in some ways. You can do things with a camera, even if you can't use a scanner. You can do things. You can take a photograph, a digital image of something, and then download that image to the computer, and then you can look at it that way. So I would imagine probably nowadays, while difficult, it's possible to digitize just about anything.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Donna Eschenbrenner. She's an archivist for the History Center of Tompkins County. Let us talk about what's in the collection. I'm fascinated just looking online and seeing some of the objects that you talk about. You've got clothing and musical instruments and scientific instruments. Talk to us about some of the unusual things you might have.
There's one thing that I love to show when I give tours. It's absolutely fabulous. It looks like a treadmill. It's this large, maybe 4 feet long and about 3, maybe 4 feet high. It looks like a machine. It's brown and it has what looks like a tread on it, but there's no mechanism. I mean, there's no place to like plug it in. And there's this thing in the front that looks like it hooks up to something. And what we determined when we did research on it, we found out it was used by late 19th century farmers. They would hook this thing up to something like a butter churn.
Wow.
And they would put a goat on this little tread, and they would have the goat walk on the tread, and the tread would in turn turn the butter churn.
Oh, my God.
So goat energy was used to churn butter.
How did you find out it was a goat?
Well, we determined goat, sheep, or dog. And I like to talk about goats because I just that the image of that just tickles my funny bone. It just looks so funny to me. So that's one that I like to highlight as much as possible because it shows a lot about what, I mean, you think about farmers in the 19th century and you think about a very basic, simple lifestyle, and mm-hmm. it probably wasn't. These were probably very resourceful, very creative people.
Yeah, and that innovative.
That very innovative, exactly. That's one that I love.
Well, any others that you can tell us? I'm really interested in toys, too, from history, because that's where innovation comes in, too. A lot of people didn't have money, and they made their own toys. There was no Toys R Us then, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, we have old toys in the collection. We have a couple of old puzzles. We have a beautiful little child's piano. We have a couple of beautiful old airplanes, probably from the 1930s or 1940s, back in the days when airplanes were becoming big and glamorous. We have maps that are just extraordinary. There's one in particular that's a favorite of mine. It's a map of New York State. And when I first saw it, when it was first donated, I didn't realize how old it was. And then I looked very carefully and I realized it's a map of the state with the county lines delineated with what looked like hand-painted watercolor lines.
Oh.
And then I realized there was no Tompkins County. And Tompkins County was formally formed in New York State in 1817. So I knew the map predated 1817. And it's just beautiful. It's just exquisite.
You know what I want to ask you, too? How do you do the research when you get these artifacts and objects and find out how old they are? How do you guess? Do you guess?
No, actually, well, at least what we're doing now, what we're trying to do as much as possible is get as much information as we can from the donor. So the donor tells us what these things are. We got a donation of diaries from the Hemingway family a few years ago, and the donor told us about the Hemingway family and who was the one that wrote the diaries and how long the diaries dated back to. We are dependent on what our donors tell us.
Uh-huh. But do you do research, too? That object that you found out was a goat churning butter. How did you do the research on that?
That was actually, I didn't do the research on that. That was done by a student. We do research on things that we've already got in the collection that we don't have information on. We did a large project dating back, starting in the late 1990s into the early 2000s, called Historic Treasures Unwrapped. We had moved to our current location in 1993, and a lot of things were still wrapped in packing boxes. Mm. So we turned this necessity into this wonderful living history project. We set up a space in the museum for work area, and we actually unpacked the boxes in front of the public, so they could watch us unwrap these things. And we did research at the time of the unpacking. So, for example, when we did the musical instruments, we found a beautiful violin that was from Dryden. It was made in Dryden by a man named Samuel Jansen Miller. And we did research on it at the time. We go to the sources that we have in our own research library. We go to the public library. Nowadays, we go online. We didn't back then, but nowadays we can do that. Or we go to other historical societies. We went to the Dryden Historical Society for information on this man, Miller, who was instrument maker back in Dryden.
Wow. That's amazing. I've always been interested in old objects, and I found some letters my grandfather wrote during the Civil War. It was so fascinating, you know.
Save them.
I will, and World War I, too. You were talking about lack of space. So what makes a historical object valuable to the historical society enough to keep? And if you don't keep it, what do you do with things that you know are of some value?
I mentioned those three criteria that we were concerned about earlier. We're also concerned about things that are unique. You know, not just is it not duplicated or is there nothing like it that's duplicated. We're interested in rounding out the collection as much as possible. We want it to be as rich and as diverse as we can possibly make it. So that's why we have textiles and objects and maps and photographs and scrapbooks and newspapers and documents. Because, as I said, the material culture of history, you know, is told in many different ways. What do we do if we don't keep something? That depends on what the thing is. If it is something that can be appropriately sent to another history museum, say, for example, somebody donates something from, say, Pennsylvania, well, we would get in contact with the museum down there and we would send it to them. If it's something that has no provenance and we have no idea where it's from and it's not appropriate for us, what we would do is probably send it to auction.
Wow. Okay. So I'm sure you get all kinds of stuff, and some of it's probably not that valuable. I mean,
right.
Honestly, things in the attic that people think are valuable sometimes aren't.
Right.
Talk to us a little bit about the 8-square schoolhouse. I found that place so fascinating when I visited. And they do reenactments. Tell us about why it's important to keep that preserved and vibrant.
The 8-square is probably the crown jewel of our collections. The interesting thing is it's actually part of the collection, even though it's a building. It dates back to 1827. It is octagonal, and that's why, hence the name 8-square. It is adorable, and it is the home of what is a fabulous and fabulously growing living history program. What some of our predecessors did was set up a program for a day at school in 1892. And our current educator, Carol West, does an amazing job working with students from all over the county, students from outside Tompkins County, homeschool kids, fourth graders in the local public schools. And she and her school teachers dress up in the costumes of school moms from 1892, and they actually give the kids really, truly what a day in the life would be like at school. In fact, my own kids did it when they were in fourth grade, and I worked with the school teacher, the fourth grade teacher at the time. I was volunteering in the classroom, and she set up a very interesting program for her kids to go to the 8-square. She had a 2-day program. She would have the kids come to school dressed up in clothing from how kids could approximate 1892. They were not allowed to use lunch boxes. They had to bring their lunches in pails. And what we did was we had the kids doing crafts and doing programs and playing with toys that were similar to what kids would have done in 1892. And the second day of the program, the kids actually went out to the schoolhouse and did their school day out there. So it was a 2-day thing. And I volunteered both of the days, and she split the class in half. And the first day, I worked with kids that had not yet been out to the schoolhouse. We had a grand time. It was wonderful. It was great. The second day, I worked with kids who had already been out and had come back, and they had to do their second day in the classroom. And they said it was nowhere near as much fun, because they said just being in that old school building created such an atmosphere of the time. What's the word? Verisimilitude. They said it was just so special that being back in the classroom was no fun.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
And you know, I visited with a fourth grade teacher, too, when I was working as an aide in the schools. And I noticed the reenactments were the people who dressed up as the teachers were actually even acting like the teachers.
Yes.
They'd slap a ruler and tell kids to simmer down. And, you know, I mean, they talk in that old-fashioned language. Some of the kids were kind of freaked out by it so much that the ones that usually would be rowdy actually did quiet down.
I believe it.
It was an amazing experience for me, too. We all did dress up.
Yeah.
All of us. The aides, the teachers. It was so much fun. Well, what do you think the importance of showing kids that kind of a past is in this day and age?
I think a connection to our past on a community level is as important as a connection to our present, as a connection to our future. It's the grounding by which we know ourselves. I mean, think about, you know, what you have in your attic. Think about the family things that you preserve. You know, you talked about letters from, you know, your grandfather. That connection gives us place and continuity in our lives. We do it on a micro level at a family level. We need to do it on a macro level at a community level. We don't know where we're going if we don't know where we've been.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, and I think we're losing some of that, too.
I do, too.
Because the world's going so fast, and people don't really value the here and now or what's happening. Talk to us also a little bit about the educational programs. I'm really interested in the Archaeology for Adults program. I'm thinking I might participate in that sometime.
That's a fabulous program. That's also out at the 8-square. The site where the building is actually a very old site.
And for all the listeners, it's on Hanshaw Road.
Hanshaw Road, exactly. There's been a schoolhouse there for almost 200 years. So just think of the detritus that's been scattered throughout the site. So an archaeologist has actually gone in and they've done digs on the site. And so it was such an interesting thing that Carol West and the archaeologist decided to make a program out of it to teach people about archaeology. It doesn't just teach about the 8-square and about schools in general, but it teaches about archaeology. So they have a running program there. They ran the pilot last year, and they're going to continue. It was so successful, they're going to continue it this year for people to come and find out what doing a dig is like.
And that happens in the summer usually, right?
Yes.
In August or something?
I think so, August.
Yeah, and this is exclusively for adults?
Yes. I think they wanted to open it up to teenagers, and they may do that as well, but it's really intended for adult learners.
God, it sounds fascinating to me. Does the Historical Society take part in preserving the 8 Square? Who takes care of maintaining it?
We do. It's ours.
So you guys have to do all that, too?
Yeah.
That must be a big job to keep that up.
It's a very big job. Yeah, it's a very big job. In fact, we recently got grant funding to help us preserve the building itself. We have a new roof on there. We have greater buttressing on the foundation. Quite a bit of work was done on just the last few years.
Yeah, it is definitely worth preserving. And if you haven't gone out and seen this, go out and see it. Really, it's amazing. Talk to us about history cafes. I think that's another interesting idea that is valuable for our culture to take part in.
History cafes are interesting. They're outreach programs that we do. Very often they're on Thursday evenings. Sometimes we do them on Saturdays. It's public programming. It's one of the ways we get our collections and our knowledge about history and make it as accessible and as engaging as possible to our public. So, for example, we'll bring in a speaker. Just yesterday, we were talking about the possibility of bringing in a speaker to talk about Cornell's sesquicentennial, because that's a big thing going on in Tompkins County in 2015. So we're talking about bringing in a speaker to talk to our public about that anniversary. And we have had speakers talk on a number of different topics over the years just to make history accessible and engaging to people.
Oh, that's great. Well, what a great resource the center is. We only have a couple of minutes left. I want to just bring this up briefly. You volunteer for the Community Science Institute. To tell us a little bit about what you do and how important it is to you.
Well, that's an amazing organization. They are a lab that does water sampling throughout Tompkins County in the creeks and in Cougar Lake. And I started volunteering for them several years ago. It's really very simple. I just take sampling bottles and I go into Six Mile Creek and I fill the sampling bottles and I fill out a form and I bring it up to the lab. But it's one of those fundamental things that to me seems sort of behind the scenes and unnoticed, but so important. The Community Science Institute does a wonderful job seeing to it that we have clean, safe water.
Yeah.
End of story. We can't live without it, and they help us preserve it. So I really do appreciate the opportunity to do work for them.
Yeah, that's a great service. Donna, real quickly, what has the study of history done to enrich your life personally?
It's broadened my horizons. It has given me context for so much of what I read, so much of what I think. It helps me move my life forward. What I talked about before about knowing where we've been. We need to know where we've been in order to know where we're going. It's helped me to do that in many ways. And I treasure the opportunity, you know, to continue to do it at a fun place like the History Center.
Well, great. Donna Eschenbrenner, thank you so much for joining us. Again, she's from the History Center of Tompkins County. You've got to go see it. You've got to go check out some of the history of our community. Can you give some contact information?
Sure. We are at 401 East State Street in the Gateway Building, right over Napoli's Pizza. Our phone number is 607-273-8284. I'm at Extension 4, or check us out online, thehistorycenter.net.
Great. Donna Eschenbrenner, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.